Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, April 23rd. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, third night of Cal Poly Humboldt protest and occupation, Humboldt zoning to allow low-cost alternative housing, and Soham Fire Safe Council to host Fire Resources Fair at the Mateel. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The Eureka Police Department is asking for assistance in locating a 58-year-old Native American man from Eureka. For more, we go to the Eureka Police Department.
Locating a missing at-risk male, Joel Lane Sr., who may appear altered. He was last seen near the 2100 block of A Street in Eureka at about 1 p.m. today. He's described as a 58-year-old Native American male, 6'2", with a thin build, black hair, and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing a black zip-up hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans, and he has a bright orange sweater underneath the sweatshirt. Anyone with information on Joel's whereabouts is asked to contact the Eureka Police Department at 707-441-4044 or their nearest law enforcement agency.
Joel Lane was last seen with a caregiver, and it's unclear what distress he may be in. The Eureka Police Department noted that if Lane is not found within a timely manner, a feather alert will be issued. Again, Joel Lane is described as a 58-year-old Native American male, 6'2", with a thin build, black hair, and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing a black zip-up hooded sweatshirt, blue jeans, and a bright orange sweater. You can see a photo of Lane on the KMUD News Facebook page. Cal Poly Humboldt students are entering the third night of their occupation of Siemens Hall on the Cal Poly campus, with fluctuating crowds of supporters outside setting up tents, barbecues, and even live music. Approximately 40 to 60 students are believed to be inside the building, with dozens of supporters outside. Despite classes being canceled or moved to remote learning, the Humboldt, California Faculty Association members stood in solidarity with student protesters on the quad this Wednesday afternoon. Here is a clip of Cal Poly faculty member and chair of faculty rights, Lauren Cannon.
We have to question what is actually happening, even if it looks like a disturbance. Even if it's some people think it's inappropriate, some people think it's unproductive. We should be like doing what we're supposed to be doing today. This is why I'm proud of those folks there to say, you know what? We need to stop. We need to think about what's going on in Gaza. Sometimes I think the weirdest thing about the world is when we lose a loved one or I'm grieving, and the world doesn't stop. Like people still go to the grocery store. When we have like horrible, some of the worst kinds of moral atrocities that's happened right now, we don't stop, usually. We just keep on going on our business.
Think about what's going on. Challenge the status quo. And try, and with that kind of thinking, says Hannah Arendt, that's one way we can make a better world. Not just for us little and humble, but our effect reaches far and wide.
Cal Poly Humboldt and University Police have not commented publicly, despite our requests. Eileen Yu, a spokesperson for Cal Poly Humboldt, sent a press release to KMUD this afternoon, which announced that the campus will remain closed through the weekend, extending the closure, which was set to end tomorrow. It also stated that students are occupying an additional building. However, no additional details were provided. The university says it is making various contingency plans, including possibly keeping the campus closed into next week. The press release also stated that numerous laws have been broken, including resisting arrest, destroying and damaging property, criminal trespass, and more. It stated that multiple local, state, and federal agencies are providing resources and support, However, those details remain unclear. You can read the full press release from the university on the KMUD News Facebook and Instagram page. For more, we spoke with student journalists who have been conducting on-the-ground reporting.
From my last count, I just counted 20 tents outside the building. And sometimes it seems like it fluctuates where people leave and come back. But now, like currently, from I just got out of the quad, there's a lot of people there, a lot of people live streaming and taking video and photos. And then there's people being there with each other. So the student community is out. Their classes are not in session, so they're on the quad.
That was Peyton Leone, the editor of the student-run bilingual publication, El Lenador.
Right now, our advisor is advising us to not enter the building just for any legal reasons of trespassing that we don't want to break, but I'm working on trying to talk to people that are inside. I know KRFH is doing good reporting. They've gotten calls from people who are inside. At least that's what they're requesting for. Sorry, let me correct that. They're requesting to talk to people who are inside. I'm not listening close enough to them.
We asked Leone if he had any additional details of other buildings being occupied on campus. He clarified,
it's not the same as with Siemens Hall. Siemens Hall is completely guarded off, blocked off with furniture and tables and chairs. Other buildings have, the doors have been cracked open. And by cracked, I mean like maybe a box put in the doorway to keep it open. And that's, people are going there to use facilities like bathrooms. So, and that's people who are out in the quad right now. I don't know who opened it or how they might have gained access to that, to those buildings. But from what I know, there's a Nelson Hall across from it that I know people are using. But in the email communication, it seems like it seems to be implying that there's students in there occupying it in the same way that Siemens Hall is. I can clarify that it's not the same type of student presence there.
Cal Poly Humboldt students run the low-power FM station, KRFH, which is also comprised of young journalists, who stated that some of the statements within the university's press release are unfounded. Here is a clip from their live broadcast earlier this afternoon.
Yeah, I want to bring up the fact that they did say protesters continue to occupy Siemens Hall plus another building. So that other building in question was reported to me to be Nelson Hall. They don't have that barricaded off, by the way. So Nelson Hall, they just have it open to use the restrooms in Nelson's Hall. So there. Also, this right here at the end of the second paragraph, adding to health and safety concerns, many toilets are no longer working. I know my toilets are working here in Gist Hall, and we just had students calling in from within Siemens Hall, the student protesters calling from within Siemens Hall, saying that all the bathrooms are fine.
Also, the water here is running. I just filled up my water bottle.
That itself is concerning. Yeah, and it's concerning that this press release wasn't sent to the students.
Yeah.
This was sent to KMUD. So again, shout out KMUD for forwarding this information to us.
Speaking with KRFH and El Lenador, students are reporting barriers and roadblocks to their reporting. And the editor of The Lumberjack agrees.
I'm Alana Hackman. I'm a fourth year at Cal Poly Humboldt, and I'm currently the co-editor-in-chief of the weekly student newspaper, The Lumberjack.
Hackman is a journalism major who has been focusing on campus issues.
Because it's so important, especially with such a small campus. No one's really covering just the campus, so we really tried to do that.
Due to the campus closure, Hackman and other student reporters have had little to no access to their newsrooms. However, they continue to report from their dorms and kitchen tables. We asked Hackman to describe the last 48 hours.
It's been crazy. I was out running errands and not really paying attention to things because I wasn't looking at notifications because my phone was dead. And then as soon as I get in the car, I just see police in Eureka like driving super fast down Broadway. And I'm like, what's going on? And then I look at my phone and all of my reporters are like, oh, there's a protest. I'm going right now. I have my camera, all of those things. So I'm so grateful that we had people on the ground already because I was unaware that it was even happening. So it was a little hectic, but we rushed over there and I immediately started the live stream. It was like around a 4-hour live stream. There were some technical difficulties. I know El Leñador was also doing a live stream, but I did about a 4-hour live stream. I was walking around, just circling Siemens, trying to get as much coverage as I could. Also sort of relaying information to concerned community members while also trying to remain factual and fact-checking. A lot of the things I was saying, I was like, these have not been fact-checked yet. So it was just getting that honest reporting out there while also just keeping live updates for the community rather than focusing on direct reporting, especially when the protest unfolded. It was just a lot of emotions and like hectic things going on. So it was best to just get some live coverage instead of asking people too many questions at the moment.
Following Monday's chaotic scene, the campus announced an extended closure, but it has limited the Lumberjacks' ability to produce timely news.
And then Tuesday, we have no access to our newsroom currently. So we used our journalism space on campus that we have an actual key for, not a key card, so we can actually get in there. There were about like 10 to 12 of us in that little house on campus, sitting on our laptops, which we never use. We always use desktops that the school provides for us, sitting on our own personal laptops, laying out a paper, a 10-page paper, while also listening to the Senate meeting in one room, a reporter keeping track of what's going on behind the barricade. And it's constant back and forth, running back and forth. And then also getting our door knocked on by faculty telling us that campus is closed and we probably don't care, as they put it, but just letting us know again. But we were all ready to write that paper. We were all determined to do so. We're such a small group, but we all hit the ground running with this story and have so much passion to just inform the public about what's going on.
The Cal Poly Humboldt Senate, a body comprised of faculty, staff, admin, and students, held their monthly meeting yesterday via Zoom due to the campus closure. Hackman attended and shared the highlights.
I sat in on the Senate meeting yesterday. That was from 3 to 5. They had an agenda set up with like budget rules and credit, no credit deadlines. And that really got pushed to the last like 20 minutes, I'd say. And the chief of staff, Mark Johnson, made a statement on behalf of Tom Jackson. And he was basically just mentioning how the students have been asked multiple times if they would like to hold the peaceful protest elsewhere, and they're refusing. So at this point, it's trespassing. And I know he mentioned something along the lines of, it wasn't a direct quote, but something along the lines of how at this point, students occupying a state government building is trespassing. So actions will need to be handled there. There was also some talk in the Senate meeting on behalf of Samuel Parker, the Associated Students President. He was speaking for Chrissy Holiday, the VP of Enrollment, and she relayed information to him before the Senate meeting that there are confidential documents in the Siemens Hall buildings. And if the students remain hands-off with those documents, they said that they will also remain hands-off. But if those documents were to be compromised, then that's when they would have to initiate things. There wasn't really much explanation on what that means or how they will be moving forward with that. There wasn't really a discussion on that. It was just a lot of discussing how the students are trespassing and they don't have a right to remain in that building. And they didn't really have a time cap for it, but it doesn't seem like the students are budging.
KEMA News requested a copy of the university Senate meeting. However, they have yet to return our request as of news time. It is believed that 40 to 60 students remain barricaded, and Hackman says her colleagues have gained access inside.
And they spoke from experience there, and they said everyone was in like high morale. Everyone is understanding, calm with each other and patient inside. And they're just really trying to work together for solidarity for Palestine. He said that he didn't see anything too wild inside. And I haven't had an update since last night, but apparently the Wi-Fi has been cut. So it's been kind of hard to do that.
We asked Hackman what their understanding of demands are and if there are reasonable concerns of anti-Semitism, which has been raised by the campus and national media outlets.
I think right now there are students who are pushing for ceasefire. there's like two sides of the protest, at least I'm seeing personally, is there are students that are pushing for ceasefire and removing occupation in Israel. And then there's also students and faculty who just want to stand with the students' right to do so. They want to support the students who are protesting and make sure that their safety is like top priority. And I feel like that's what I'm seeing more in a sense of. I haven't seen anything really like anti-Semitic or hateful against any groups besides the IDF and like government officials, as well as like the police officers that were there to mediate. I haven't really seen any negative comments on anyone else besides those individuals. And those are larger groups of people. I haven't seen anything that I would qualify as anti-Semitic. But again, that's not really my place to qualify what things are anti-Semitic or not. I'm not a Jewish woman, but I think it's just a lot of solidarity between students, staff, and faculty right now. And whether they're protesting for ceasefire or not, I think a lot of people are there just to support the students and make sure that their safety and their right to their First Amendment is protected right now.
KMUD programmer and volunteer journalist Daniel Nickerson is currently on scene reporting from the Cal Poly Quad. He stated that the campus is currently mellow and without a police presence. Students are sitting on the lawn outside of Siemens Hall, creating art and making food. Protesters inside Siemens Hall have released a list of needs, which include Ziploc bags, ACE bandages, sidewalk chalk, saline solution, camping supplies, utensils, and more. A station has been set up outside of the hall to drop off donated items. You can see a full list on the KMUD News Facebook page. And to stay up to date on all things Cal Poly protest, you can follow El Lenador, The Lumberjack, and KRFH on social media. You can also follow KMUD News and hear our previous reporting and coverage by visiting soundcloud.com/KMUD News. Humboldt County is trying to expand the types of housing available to residents who are struggling to find housing they can afford. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Responding to what's been described as a local housing crisis, the county wants to work tiny houses and other low-cost housing options into its zoning regulations. Funded by the state, a planning effort to broaden the range of allowable housing types has produced a framework for a new ordinance allowing movable and fixed tiny houses, mobile homes, RVs, and tents. The county's planning commission got a first look at the plan during an April 18th workshop. Commissioners support making regulations as flexible as possible to allow maximum housing cost reduction. And during a public comment period, Praj White said the low-cost housing plan needs to be doable in all county areas.
It appears the ordinance is excluding many communities that could benefit due to the limited zoning options. It feels inequitable to many parts of the county. Not everyone wants to live in town. The proposed zones are almost all next to the main highway and arterials and do not provide for equitable development throughout the diverse and rural county. I suggest that community planning areas and communities should have the possibility of tiny home villages. From Garberville, Redway, Bryceland, Edersburg, Honeydew, Petrolia, Hydesville, Bloxburg, Willow Creek, Glendale, McKinleyville, Fieldbrook, and others.
Other commenters questioned proposed requirements such as parking spaces even in alternative lodge parks, the most wide-ranging housing category that includes tents and other membrane structures. Commissioner Peggy O'Neill discouraged making tiny house villages too similar to conventional housing.
There's different classifications, I think, in these villages. You could have rapid rehousing, you could have safe and sober housing, you could have domestic violence housing, but this doesn't cover any of that in my mind. It just says, okay, you can put something together. You know, as far as I can tell, if you did a tiny house village, you know, 10 units, you're going to comply with this ordinance, you're going to spend several million dollars just to get to that point, to have water, sewer, parking, foundations, electricity, all of that's going to cost millions. I mean, just to buy a pre-made tiny house is, you know, minimum $75,000 to $120,000 if it has, you know, showers and toilets and all of that. And if you look at other communities, they've gone from, in some cases, a stepped up approach where, you know, for some people just living in a very minimal, maybe 10 by 12 unit that provides them a place to sleep without being accosted.
Commissioner Noah Levy also vouched for keeping housing costs low.
I hope that this ordinance can allow for a range of tiny house villages and emergency housing villages that frankly offer greater or lesser amenities, luxuries, parking spaces. But, you know, the more we require things like that, it does tend to drive up the price. And I think for some tiny house villages, that's really desirable and appropriate, but for others, perhaps not. I also agree with the folks who've come in tonight saying that I think we need to, while certainly encourage this in the more densely developed urban areas, I think we really do need to make sure that this can work for the rural parts of the county where they have the same need for low, relatively affordable housing.
Planning staff will seek more input through meetings with community members and will return with alternatives for the commission's review. Another prong of the county's quest to expand housing is to allow it in more areas, including commercial, industrial commercial, and business park zones. The commission workshopped a draft commercial residential ordinance and made some suggestions, such as increasing proposing housing density above 16 units per acre. The draft ordinance will be considered again in a future public hearing. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Soham Fire Safe Council will host a fire resources fair this week. Serenity Wood brings you the details.
The Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council will host their fire resources fair at the Mateel Community Center from noon to 5 on April 27th for the second year. The Fire Resources Fair is a, quote, treasure trove of resources, according to Southern Humboldt Fire Safe Council Chair Gail Eastwood. In a Zoom interview, she said that this gala-style event will provide an update from last year's Fire Resources Fair, in that this time the two presentations will be, quote, very different from one another.
We'll be hosting just really a treasure trove of resources that will help you make your home, you know, your neighborhood, more resilient to the wildfires that we know are coming one of these days. This year we have two presentations, and very different from one another. The first one at 1 o'clock will be a panel that will include 9 of our neighborhood fire safe councils and FireWise communities. So communities that are organized to do fire resiliency and fire preparedness work in their own little area. Although they're all organized either as fire safe councils or as FireWise communities, they're all really different in their character. The thing they have all in common is that they've all sat down and really thought in terms of fire. And then what can we do about it? And then started doing those things. So this will be a packed panel. To the best of my knowledge, it'll include all the FireWise and FireSafe councils. As I mentioned, very different and very different forms of organization.
For instance, even though Shelter Cove is funded by their district and Edersburg has their own 501c3 nonprofit status already, other groups like Palo Verde and Garberville have much more informal structures and yet have been greatly successful in problem solving for a collective fire-safe future, explained Eastwood.
The Harris Fire Safe Council is outstanding for the amount of volunteer energy that they've put into their fuel breaks on the road and around vulnerable people's houses. And they're being rewarded by, you know, they've got the organization together, so it attracts resources from the outside, you know, it attracts agencies to go, oh, well, those Harris people, they do our permission forms for us, you know, they do the interface with the landowners. We can work with them. So they're very inspiring. All of the groups are inspiring with the work that they're doing. And
Eastwood observed in our interview that despite their disparate origin stories, each of these groups share similar accomplishments and the same vision of cultivating a fire-resilient future.
And a bunch of those groups are having tables. So you can circulate afterwards and ask all your questions and hopefully get inspired either to participate in your neighborhood that's already organized or to organize your own neighborhood.
The first panel of smaller neighborhoods plans to demonstrate that there aren't many hoops to jump through. After all, it only takes 8 households to start a FireWise community, according to Eastwood. The second presentation, hosted by Jana Valakovic, will circle back on the lessons about DIY home hardening and defensible space that were offered at last year's event.
The second presentation is Jana Valakovic. She's our SoHum girl. She grew up here. And she is the primo fire preparedness educator. Works for University of California Extension in rural Northern California. She really knows her stuff. With all the latest research on how is it that houses actually catch on fire during a wildfire, and what can you do to prevent that from happening to your home or to other homes in your neighborhood? What they call home hardening, you know, which has to do with your materials and constructions and defensible space, basically the burnable stuff, mostly vegetation around your house. I thought I knew a lot. I learned stuff from her presentation. And there will also be information. She'll give us an update on fire insurance, which is a hot topic, as it were.
Numerous Southern Humboldt households have recently experienced having their fire insurance canceled, with the only option available being the state-sponsored FAIR plan, which has a reputation for being substantially more expensive than the insurance plans which were canceled. Many homeowners, lacking thousands of dollars to pay for this FAIR plan, are opting to go uninsured and to try and reduce their need for fire insurance through home hardening, fuel load reduction, and similar anti-fire measures. On a lighter note, Eastwood mentioned a bake sale and a kids zone, complete with a free play puppet theater, cornhole, pinwheels, and bubbles, plus a fire education for kids themed scavenger hunt with prizes.
So this is designed as a family-friendly event, and there will be a kids zone with interesting activities for kids up to teenage years, I think. There's a scavenger hunt in the works, you know, slightly older kids. And of course, there will be food. We're having a bake sale. If you'd like to contribute some baked goods, or welcome to contact sohumfiresafe@gmail.com. Also, of course, you're welcome to come and show up and buy your drinks. And enough sweet and savory baked goods will be on hand so that we can all be sustained through a very interesting and stimulating afternoon. We have a wide variety of organizations tabling. I mentioned our neighborhood groups. We also have Natasha Carrico from the Wailaki Cultural Burn Crew. And we're really excited about that table. It was a really interesting table last year with samples on hand of some of the materials that are culturally used that are fostered by the use of good fire. And we're also having a table from the Southern Humboldt Prescribed Burn Association, which is a really nice, you know, those two in our area really fit together, the way we think about prescribed fire and the way we think about cultural uses. I think we're becoming educated about that.
I spoke with Natasha in a separate interview on the 12th.
Yeah, so Wailaki Cultural Fire is going to have a table at the Mateel, and I'll have brochures, we'll be there to answer any questions, and I really hope to see people stop by. So I'll have samples of cultural plants that we use for basketry, cultural items, resources available for people to look, you can touch them, ask questions about them, learn how fire affects them or doesn't affect them. So yeah, stop by, ask us a lot of questions. We're really excited to share our cultural knowledge.
It's really great that the Eel River Wailaki group is really into educating people, you know, sharing their many centuries of cultural knowledge. Just the chance to network, to walk around and talk with other people who are knowledgeable and involved and I think anybody who is concerned about fire, who has something they think about their own house or their own situation, or their own neighborhood, will find a lot of really, really good connections at the fair. We're inviting everybody out there to join us April 27th for our gala fire resources fair. It'll be at the Mateel Community Center from noon to 5 on April 27th. So anybody who would like more information or who is interested in volunteering can contact us at sohumfiresafe@gmail.com.
For KMUD, I'm Serenity Wood.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Serenity Wood, and Daniel Nickerson. Reporting remotely for KMUD, I'm Lauren Schmidt.